Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of The Naturalist Capitalist. This one I kind of threw together quickly, but this guy just came across my view yesterday. I was already following him on Twitter, and he'd been following me, but I didn't actually notice him until yesterday. So any of you who follow me on Twitter, you know I got into it with the 9/11 kook movement yesterday, and you know me on Twitter, like I'm pretty volatile and I say stuff that kind of purposefully ruffles feathers, but I ignited a lot of controversy. A lot of people got really angry at me. And then I saw this guy, Adam Fitzgerald. He was coming to my defense. He even put a short video together explaining the position I was taking and why it matters that hijackers do exist in the 9/11 story. And if you take that out of the picture, the whole story falls apart. But anyway, he's here with me today, Adam Fitzgerald. He's got a great YouTube channel. I went and watched a couple of his videos. He's had a lot of interesting people on, talked about 9/11, foreign policy, all sorts of stuff. How are you doing today, man?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah. So you have the Darkened Hour podcast. How long have you been doing that for?
Well, that came about in 2019, actually. It was just an extension of a series I worked on with Richard Cox, who I met back in 2017 on Facebook when I had it. I ran to him by accident. He actually interviewed somebody in the 9/11 Truth Movement who was very critical of skeptics. And he wrote a paper. It was a thesis for college. His name was Dr. Richard Elifritz. And I told Richard Cox, I said, well, you know, there's another side to that story. And he wanted to know more about me. And I told him what I was about, and he interviewed me for his own podcast, which is Deep Space Consciousness. That interview lasted about an hour and a half to 2 hours, and he never heard of 9/11 put forth in a timeline in a fashion which was condensed in such a manner. And he wanted to do a project. And I had an idea. Now, I read a book called The Terror Timeline, which was written by a very famous and spectacular 9/11 researcher himself, Paul Thompson. And I wanted to do, because I'd never seen it before, to do a timeline leading up to the events of September 11th in a way where everybody could understand it. So I tried to come at it very simply, but it took, I think it was 18 series videos, and it lasted, I think, 14 months. But it was a work in progress. And what we did was we broke it down to where the foundation of radical Islamist, which is Wahhabi Islam. And then we integrated the intelligence apparatuses from countries like Saudi Arabia, which is the Mockbeth. And then you have the Israel with the Mossad. And then you have Pakistan with the ISI. And all these agencies integrate into these groups to manipulate them for a greater geopolitical goal. And that's how what happened with 9/11. And that series ended. When that series ended, he says, oh, why don't we try to come up with an idea where we talk about the really finer details that we missed out. And I said, well, you know, how about we do a podcast? And he liked the idea. And I came up with the name. He liked the name. And we came up with the soundtrack to it. And the first people we interviewed were actually people we have no idea what we're talking about when it came to physics. So we talked with David Chandler, who's a big face in the Truth Movement, Wayne Costi, Ross Muir. But this was out of our depth. So we finally got to interviewing a couple of other people. And then we really got lucky because near the end, we started interviewing real heavyweights, one of them being Mark Rossini, who worked in Alex Station out of the FBI counterterrorism office in New York, Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer, who worked on a defense intelligence agency, U.S. Army program called Able Danger. Eric Kleinsmith worked for the Land Information Warfare's Activity Division related to Able Danger. Even Lawrence Wilkerson, the former White House advisor to Secretary of State Colin Powell. So I got very fortunate in interviewing these people. And that's because I wasn't too fantastical in regards to fringe conspiracies. I am a conspiracy theorist, and I think there's plenty of anomalies regarding 9/11, but nothing to the fantastical. And I'm pretty sure you have a lot of questions regarding those issues because we've came across each other yesterday on a thread that you made, which was enormous in its own entirety.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't expect it to blow up that way. I watched Loose Change, I think in 2010, sometime around that. I don't remember exactly what year. But I've been fascinated by 9/11 since I was a kid. I was 7 years old when 9/11 happened, but I still remember it very clearly. It terrified me. And once I became a teenager, I sort of became obsessed with it. And, you know, I knew the names of all the flights and a lot of the hijackers and, you know, what size the planes were. And I knew about the physics of the buildings. And so, like, way more than your average kid would have known. Nothing like what you or Ryan Dawson or any of these people know. But I knew more than the average person. And then, you know, I saw Loose Change, and it just really gave me a bitter taste toward the whole skepticism of what was going on with 9/11, because it was just ridiculous. And then beyond Loose Change, it got way dumber. I mean, the idea of, like, there were no planes that hit the World Trade Center at all, that they were holograms or that they were CGI'd in later, and that they just paid off a bunch of people to say that they saw planes hit the buildings. You know, and it gave me, like, a really sour taste toward it. And I just kind of completely shelved the entire idea of anything except the official narrative being true, until I found out about Ryan Dawson. And I found out about him in 2016. Mm-hmm. And I didn't watch him a lot, but over the last couple of years, I watched War by Deception and Empire Unmasked, and then I've had him on my show a lot, and it started really opening my mind up to, like, an alternative truth movement compared to what I was so used to, just the ridiculousness. But before we get into the specifics, I just wanted to talk about that, like, the idea that the kook movement has done more to draw attention away from the actual anomalies or the actual weirdness of 9/11. It's done more to destroy interest in exploring those areas than the establishment could have ever hoped for. Would you agree with that?
Yes, actually, unfortunately. My experience with them came on Facebook, evidently, because when I came to Facebook, I was very naive. So I made a real profile in 2000, I think, in 16, and I stuck with it until this year. I deleted it on the anniversary because of the lack of any type of rational discussion surrounding an important topic, a topic I'm very invested with. The only good thing about Facebook was that it offers you a variety of forums where there's a large community in some of them. This doesn't happen on Twitter or any other viral media. Unfortunately, with Facebook, they become so restrictive of certain people. A lot of the sound voices basically got subjected to restrictions and suspensions. One of them being Ryan Dawson, and another one who's a continual person who gets suspended a lot is DJ Thermal Detonator. When you take these people outside of the spectrum, all you're left with basically are the loud voices who are stuck in viral media. These people who basically purport no planes or no hijack or CGI, Judy Wood, they're stuck in viral media. And they don't come out. They don't promote their own work. They don't write anything. They don't have any videos of their own or channels. Very few do. And so because of that, you're basically, if you're in Facebook, you're surrounded by these fringe conspiracy theorists that are basically destroying the conversation surrounding 9/11. And they're doing the work of the intelligence services right away. So if the CIA, in other words, the CIA doesn't need to infiltrate the 9/11 truth movement because they're doing the work of the CIA. They're actually promoting these theories that absolve them. And I think with your thread yesterday, I made a point in, like, you know, if there's no hijackers, that means there's no foreign intelligence services who are monitoring them inside the United States. That the two agencies that were found were Saudi Arabia and Israel. And that's who they were monitoring inside the United States without informing the FBI and the State Department. That's huge, because the FBI didn't know what was going on. Meanwhile, these intelligence agencies know what's going on and didn't inform not just the FBI, the Justice Department, but to the State Department as well. And so 9/11 happens. And guess what? Saudi and Israeli, all those agents, they get deported back. So we can't interview them in the two congressional inquiries. Whether you want to believe that was intentional or not, I leave that up to you. It's speculation, but it's coincidental at least. And that's what gave rise to these fringe conspiracy theories, because they're not used to seeing deliberate plane crashes. So right. when you, and for example, we'll talk about the Pentagon here. The Pentagon, where it's alleged American Airlines Flight 77 crashed into the Pentagon, and what came of it was very little plane debris was survived. No wings, no large pieces of the fuselage. Well, that's what would happen when a plane is going 563 miles an hour carrying 14,000 pounds of fuel. Now, to the regular person, it would seem, because this is what happened to me. When I first looked at the Pentagon issue, and it was from Loose Change, I said, you know, they got a really good point here. You know, I the plane crashes I'm used to seeing are where you see large pieces of the plane, wings, a tail. And it came after many, many years later where I started understanding comparing plane crashes. And it's disingenuous, because when you look at unintentional plane crashes, this is where the pilot is trying to land the plane safely by dumping the fuel and to land on its belly at the lowest speeds possible, most likely on grass or a hilly road or whatever. That's not what happened on September 11th in any of these crash sites. All these planes were intentionally crashed at the highest speeds possible while fully loaded for fuel. And that's the reason why you don't see much in the way of large plane debris. And this isn't the first time that's happened. The most recent intentional plane crash I could think of is in 2015. You had Germanwings 9525, which was a large airliner itself, the size of a Boeing, which crashed into the side of the Andes Mountain, the Alps. And over there, and that's where I made a video, and I'll talk about this in a bit. The plane crashed in the Alps, and it was very, they recovered no bodies. They've recovered very little in the terms of human remains. And that the largest piece of the plane they found was the tire. And so, yes, we do have intentional plane crashes, but they're very, very rare. More rare than a regular plane crash where it's unintentional. So I can understand why people are hesitant to disbelieve that no plane, that a plane couldn't have crashed in Shanksville or into the Pentagon, because there was very little plane debris noticeable. But that's what happens when it's an intentional plane crash site.
Yeah, I want to talk about the Pentagon a little bit.
Sure.
There's a lot of disinformation that's just, you know, you can disprove it immediately. I mean, the idea that there's like this crazy triple corkscrew turn that they had to make. I mean, it's the flight pattern is like one giant loop that's miles wide. He turns all the way around and then he crashes into the Pentagon. And a lot of people also who are using that point, I would ask them, why would a missile do that? Why would a missile make a turn like that before going into the Pentagon? What's the point? Why would it be anything other than an airplane? The other thing is you have all the light posts that are knocked over from the airplane descending right toward the Pentagon. You have, I think, 130 eyewitnesses. And if you want to claim that they were all planted there and, you know, they were all paid off, I mean, okay. I guess that's your right to think that, but it's kind of ridiculous. And then you also, you know, it's a concrete wall that the plane smashes into. Like I was getting into an argument with people about this yesterday. With the World Trade Center, the planes cut through the steel beams on the outside walls, and everyone's saying like, well, you had the plane, you had the wings cut through the steel, but you don't have the wings on the Pentagon. So on the World Trade Center, the outer steel columns, they were 4 inches thick on the base of the building, but at the top of the building, they were only a quarter inch thick. So you had the planes hitting at like, I forget what it's, what's the 93rd floor on the North Tower and the 72nd on the South Tower. Is that right?
Yeah, 74th, 75th.
Yeah, somewhere. Yeah. So you're pretty high up the building. Like you're talking thin steel versus a concrete wall. So you're obviously not going to have the plane slice through a concrete wall in the Pentagon. But I just found that like a lot of people didn't realize any of this evidence was out there. They didn't realize there were all these eyewitnesses. They didn't realize that there were pictures of pieces of the plane all over the lawn, that there were pictures of the lamppost being knocked over. So a lot of this is like, and I mean, I'm not an expert on 9/11. I just know more than the average person, but you don't need to know a ton to disprove a lot of these stupid theories. I mean, you can do it pretty easily.
Well, you can. And you just, it takes is honest, independent research. So I tell regular people this, you don't need to be an expert. As you say, You just need to be in a way of like the mindset of a crime scene investigator. So, for example, let's use the Pentagon again. You go into the Pentagon issue, you look at it like a crime scene investigator would. You look at the clues that are left behind, and then you interview the people who were actually at the scene of the crime. And what do they say? So instead of listening to people like Christopher Bolin or Rebecca Roth, you know, these people who purport, you know, no planes at the Pentagon or no hijackers, well, they're basically saying that because they weren't there and they're not listening to the people or reading about the people who are actually there and contradict their points. I mean, it's pretty easy to disseminate what is true and what is not, but you have to really have an unbiased mind. And when I talk about that, I'm talking about, you know, not being persuaded by any religious or political or racial worldview. You really have to be an honest investigator and go with the evidence to where it leads. And from my experience, I can't talk about yours or anybody else's. From my experience, every single no player, this is not generalization either, every single no player I've ever met wants to blame Israel, right? But, however, their position is that if there's no hijackers, no planes, basically absolves the Israeli Mossad from having even foreknowledge of the event. And why is that? Because it is the Israeli Mossad who were using front companies, as well as an art student ring. There was actually three rings, and it was a drug ring as well. But the two biggest rings, who were monitoring who? The hijackers in Florida, in New Jersey, in New York. So without hijackers, guess what? You basically absolved Israel from even not just complicity, if you want to make the argument there, that's hard, but foreknowledge at least, yeah, you don't have that either. And that goes the same with the Saudis who were actually giving money to two hijackers out west, Khalid al-Midar and Nawaf al-Azmi, as well as the CIA and the NSA who were monitoring the phone calls of these people years prior to 9/11. So all of this doesn't exist because you don't want to believe a plane had crashed into the Pentagon, Shanksville, or even at the World Trade Center. And look at your position and what it does in terms of who you're absolving in terms of a bigger crime, which is what happened after 9/11, which we, you know, the Afghan invasion, Iraq war, after that, Syria, Libya, the bigger geopolitical issues, the really bigger crimes that arisen out of 9/11, that was allowed to rise on 9/11. Well, you can't blame anybody. There's no hijackers. You know, everybody likes to say that, well, the Saudis were patsies. Whether they were or not, that's irrelevant. The bigger issue is we're trying to put the pieces together to show that there was a much bigger conspiracy behind the transparent conspiracies that are being purported in the truth movement, which I must say, you know, I went down to the World Trade Center this year for the 20th anniversary because I live up here in New York. And unfortunately, there was, you know, the regular truth crowds that were purporting, you know, no planes and no hijackers, and the hijackers are still alive, and all these laughable issues that exist still today. It's unfortunate.
Yeah. You just did a great video on Ziad Jarrah that I watched. And that is one of the biggest true areas of, you know, conspiracy that I think a lot of people overlook, especially if you don't believe that, you know, Flight 93 had hijackers on it or that, you know, Ziad Jarrah was even, you know, involved at all. But why don't you talk about the video you just did about him and all his ties to Israeli intelligence and just all the unanswered questions surrounding him?
Sure, gladly. Well, this is an issue that we can actually are trying to prove. Myself and DJ Thermal Detonator, Ryan Dawson touches on this as well. We're trying to show that there was actually Israeli complicity in the attacks. And this is the one area that, now, of course, what I'm saying is speculation right now, but right, there's a lot of smoke where there could be a fire. Regarding Ziad Jarrah, now Ziad Jarrah is alleged by the FBI in the 9/11 Commission report to be the hijacker pilot of United Airlines Flight 93, and which crashed into the field in Shanksville. But I did a background of Ziad Jarrah many times, and he comes from a very secular background. He was born in the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon. His family was very well-to-do. They were friends with Jews, Christians. He grew up with a lot of these people. He then relocates to Germany to major in electrical engineering at the University of Greifswald. And he goes there with his cousin, Salim Aljara. And while there, he runs into his girlfriend, Aziel Sunguin. And from there, with a guy with no religious background at all, goes to the most fervent and radical mosque in all of Germany, in Hamburg, called Al-Quds. And it was led by a fiery imam named Muhammad Fazizi, who is known for his very virulent Western ideas and values against Israel, the United States, and Western worldviews. Just unbelievably, right into the fire. So he goes and attends this mosque and meets with future 9/11 hijackers, Muhammad Atta, Ramzi bin al-Shib, who's a coordinator, and Marwan al-Shehi. Now, Atta is alleged to have pilot American Airlines 11. Marwan al-Shehi is alleged to have pilot 175. Over the years, the intelligence apparatuses, especially Germany and the CIA, are monitoring this mosque. And so they're listening to phone calls. They're taking pictures of these people for years. And they run into these two guys. And these two guys basically groom them to be radical fundamentalists. One of them, his name is Mohammed Haydar Zamar, and the other one is Mahmoud Darkanzali. And these are Syrians, Germans, Syrians living in Germany, gun runners, have connections to Al-Qaeda. In fact, Zamar is a high-level recruiter for Al-Qaeda. So Ziad Jarrah is actually, at this point, living alone in a room. He rents it from this woman. He never lives with any of these people, none of the hijackers, none of the operatives, whatever. He goes to Afghanistan. He's alleged to have met Mohammed Atta there. Actually, there's only one video that actually survives. It's a silent video, no noise, where he's sitting with Mohammed Atta. It's the only evidence that he's with them at any point. So he takes part in 9/11. Allegedly, he hijacks 93, pilots it, crashes into Shanksville. The story doesn't end there. Because when you look at the background of his family, it gets very interesting. In 2011, a cousin of his named Ali Aljara, an uncle, Ali Aljara is arrested. He is the uncle to Ziad Jarrah. He's the second cousin to Ali Aljara. And it is alleged by Hezbollah, who arrested him in Lebanon, that he was a spy for Israel for 25 years. Mm-hmm. He's been giving them pertinent information. One of the last bits of information he gave to the Israeli Mossad was the assassination of Imad Mughniyeh, who is a second lieutenant in command of Hezbollah. He was killed by the CIA and Israeli on a drone strike, I think, or he was, forgot the nature in which he was, I think it was a drone strike. But anyway, he gets arrested. And then later on, Ali Aljara's brother gets arrested, Joseph Aljara, and he was alleged to have helped him for 10 years. Now, that doesn't stop there, because he has an uncle named Asim Aljara. Asim Aljara is actually a spy for Libya, Germany, Israel, and I want to say maybe Jordan at one point, for 20 years. And this goes all the way back to his connections with the Abu Nidal organization, who Abu Nidal, for most people don't know, is an alleged Israeli Arab terrorist who is a financier, a contractor. He was hired even by the Israeli Mossad to do counterintelligence, basically against the Palestinian Liberation Organization, because he created a splinter group off that called Fatah, which basically is a more radical group than the PLO. So basically, it was just trying to destroy the PLO in the process. All of this is a huge red flag. I mean, just enormous, to show that Ziad Jarrah, this alleged, you know, clean-cut young man, is basically with no religious training whatsoever. None of his family members could even believe that he was even on the plane, not, you know, much less being a radical fundamentalist, which didn't even make sense for even, you know, people who knew him in the later years. But look at the background of his family. But if you don't believe in hijackers, you don't look at all of this, because it doesn't exist. Because why would you look at the profile of a person you claim that doesn't exist?
Yes, specifically.
Just one instance. This is just one instance with one hijacker where we could show that not only did Israel have foreknowledge, but they may have had an Israeli mole inside the Hamburg cell to allow 9/11 to happen all the way until the day itself. Because according to, now I have to add this too, with Flight 93, now it's alleged by the FBI and the 9/11 Commission that there were four hijackers on that plane. Ziad Jarrah is the pilot. And you have the Mosul hijackers, Saeed Al-Ghamdi, Ahmed El-Nami and Ahmed El-Hasnawi. It crashes. But there were 6 phone calls that were made on that plane that were connected. And a lot of these phone calls didn't connect because nobody was on the other line. 4 of them from passengers, 2 from flight attendants. And you know how many hijackers they said was on that plane?
3. Yep.
All 3 men were dark-skinned males. All 3 men were wearing red bandanas. And guess what? You go pull up a picture of Ziad Jarrah.
Not dark-skinned
male?
No.
Right on.
Yeah.
So, yes. Yeah. These are the real anomalies for 9/11 that I'm talking about, that people like Ryan Dawson, Robbie Martin, DJ Thermal Detonator, Kevin Fenton, Ray Nowalski, all these guys were trying to shake you people, you no-planers, no-hijackers, into saying, look at what you're really throwing away for a fringe conspiracy that basically makes no sense.
Yeah, and I wanted to say this is specifically Flight 93 too, like, because there's some people who, you know, they believe that the 2 planes hitting the World Trade Center are real, but then the other 2 are made up, or even that the one that hit the Pentagon is real. But Flight 93 is the one that the most people don't believe actually existed, or that it was shot down, or that, you know, it wasn't hijacked or whatever. But it's the most important flight, as you're pointing out. Like, it's the one that ties everything together. So if you specifically don't believe in this plane being hijacked, then, I mean, the whole story goes out the window as far as Israeli connection, at least.
Sure. And, you know, it's not just an Israeli connection, it's a Saudi connection as well. And the bigger connections are the CIA and the NSA. The NSA basically is the one agency nobody talks about. But they had for years, going all the way back to 1992, they had a monitoring device on Bin Laden's satellite phone. That lasted from 1992 to 1998. And they also had a listening device, as well as monitoring the phone calls of the Al-Qaeda Yemen hub in Sana'a, Yemen, from 1996 to 2002. What do you think they were talking about on those phone calls? All the operations, 1998 East Africa bombings, the 2000 USS Cole bombing, the Millennium Plot, and 9/11. But we can't access that information because we still have the trial that still hasn't happened after 20 years regarding the 5 major al-Qaeda leaders in Guantanamo Bay, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Ramzi Bin al-Shihab, Ahmed al-Hasnawi, and the rest of them. But I don't think there'll ever be a trial because I've interviewed former FBI agent Ken Williams, who wrote the Phoenix memo warning the United States about al-Qaeda operatives flying at flight schools. He basically says when he went to Guantanamo, he thinks that the United States government is going to cut a deal with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and take the death penalty off the table in order for him to plead guilty to 9/11. And if that happens, all the prosecution evidence or whatever evidence they have or lack thereof is now locked away at the National Archives for the next 30, 40 years. Yeah. So that means we'll never know what they had or didn't have. And even if they did have, basically all the admissions made by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and these guys were made under duress, torture. And so it would, that's why their defense attorneys are basically praying to get the trial gun, because these guys are going to walk.
Yeah. So where is Ziad Jarrah? Is he still alive, do you think? Or did they take him out? Or like, what's the deal with him if he wasn't on Flight 93?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, my theory is that he never got on the plane, but everything I say here, please take with a grain of salt, because it's all speculation.
Sure.
All right. So I don't think Ziad Jarrah ever got on that plane. I think he was an Israeli mole that the CIA wanted, because the CIA wanted to turn 2 people, Khalid Al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hazmi, but they didn't speak English. Ziad Jarrah spoke English. And he came from a very intelligence-laden background with his family. I think that he was the Israeli mole that they needed, and they wanted to know every intricate detail of the plot, in which they did. How do you think Israel and Saudi Arabia even know who to follow in New York and in out West? How did they know who to follow these people? Well, basically, if you put 2 and 2 together, it was the CIA and the NSA who were monitoring these people way back and listening to their phone calls. So they asked the Israeli and Saudis to monitor them inside the United States, because the CIA is not legally, they can't legally operate inside the United States with a live operation. Ziad Jarrah, where is he? I don't know. But what's strange is this. His girlfriend, Asia Sanguine, went into the witness protection program. Why? Her life was not much in the way of being threatened. She actually walked into the German police station, gave them testimony about Ziad Jarrah, and ever since then, disappeared off the face of the earth. No one knows where Ziad Jarrah is or what he's doing, but he did leave a message. He wrote a letter to Aziel Sangwin. You can Google Aziel Sangwin Ziad Jarrah letter. Ziad Jarrah, this is the last letter he ever wrote, and he wrote it to his girlfriend. However, he wrote the wrong address. Now, if you're a Ziad Jarrah and you're writing to the love of your life, the girlfriend that you love, you want to marry, you're going to make sure everything on that letter is basically right down to the dotted I correct. Mm-hmm. He wrote the he wrote a wrong address. Okay. That the mail got back to it was a return to sender, and the FBI intercepted it and they got the letter. But if you read the letter, it's very cryptic. And it basically didn't insinuate he was alive, but it said that I will see you in time soon at a place where I can't talk about. I love you, and basically all this stuff. Read the letter. It's very interesting, but it makes you think that, wow, maybe he's actually telling her that he's in the witness protection program and he's going to meet her there, because why else would she be in witness protection? Her life wasn't in danger or anything like that. Or maybe, you know, they felt that, you know, people would harass her or anything like that. Who knows? I mean, but, you know, like I said, this is speculation at best. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, something that a lot of the no planers point to is the fact that his passport was recovered at the crash site of Flight 93, which that is actually a huge red flag. It's like this plane was pretty much vaporized because it went straight into the ground and, you know, was full of fuel. And, you know, that is actually a really questionable thing that a passport would survive this. But they just throw it all out the window after that. It's like, yeah, you were so close. Like you were on the right. You were right about being skeptical about this, but then you just throw the whole story out the window and then it's gone. So obviously they planted the passport there, right? I mean, that's pretty much a given.
Well, this is another area. I'm glad you brought this up, because I think this is important to talk about regarding Ziad Jarrah's passport. Now I'll talk about the other passports too. There was a passport that was found in Lower Manhattan, I think it was about a block or two away, belonging to Satam al-Saskami, who was on board Flight 11. They also found a burnt passport at the Pentagon belonging to Khalid al-Midar. But Ziad Jarrah's passport was basically found, and not only was that found, but it was a business card also found at the crash site, which was a business card of his uncle, Assam al-Jarrah, who had handwritten notes behind it, and the address was an address in Germany where Mohammed Atta and Ramzi bin al-Shib and Ziad Jarrah once lived, Marwan al-Shehi once lived. Why that was found, I don't know. I have no idea. But Ziad Jarrah's passport, we believe, and this is the theory that I'm working on, was planted by two people from Urban Moving Systems. Now, these two guys, nobody ever brings up. Everybody talks about the dancing Israelis. I don't think they were important. Not as important these two guys were about to tell you now. These two guys were Israelis, and their names are Roy Barak and Modi Butbol. Now, they worked at Urban Moving Systems in Weehawken, in New Jersey. They were going on a client delivery, I believe. I always get this wrong. I think it's Ohio. They were going to Ohio to move a client. While they were going there, there was a Beyond the Lookout bolo by the East Rutherford Police Department, and then soon the FBI, and everybody was looking for Urban Moving Systems van. And when they pulled this truck over, they found that these guys really did work there. They were allowed to leave because they didn't break anything, any laws. September 12th, the next day, they are coming back from Ohio, passing through, I think it's Route 81, which is right near Shanksville. But I couldn't tell you. But they were pulled over in a town called York, Pennsylvania, by the Pennsylvania State Police Department. At this time, 9/11, it's finished. Everybody's now looking for Urban Moving Systems, any trucks related to it. So they pull them over, and it's different cops, but they get pulled over again. And then they describe to the police officers that they were in the process of moving a client, but the client was from Ohio, and when they look in the truck, it's empty. Nothing in the truck. So they call the manager of Urban Moving Systems, Dominic Souter. And so they call him, and they say, did you have a client outside of New Jersey? And what Dominic Souter said was even more flabbergasting. He said, due to the prior day's events, we had no clientele outside the state of New Jersey. And he says, well, how can you explain there's two workers here in York, Pennsylvania? And Dominic Suter then said, quote, it's strange. And that's all he said. He had no answer for it. And what happened? The very next day, Dominic Suter flees to Israel, leaving behind all the client's warehouse, their furniture, everything behind. Dom and the two Israelis, Roy Barak and Moti Bupol, they're held at a FBI facility for, I believe it was a month. It was a little bit less than the five other Israelis that were detained by the Eth brothers and later to the FBI. They were detained, I think, for 71 days. But these guys, Roy Barak, Moti Bupol, had much more interesting backgrounds. They were from the Signals Intelligence Division of the Mossad themselves, whereas you had two males, I think it was Paul and Steven Kurzberg, the brothers, who were involved with the Mossad themselves. But everybody, this is something that's misconstrued. Every male over the age of 18 goes and serves with the Israeli military at some point. But there was real good Signals Intelligence background with these two guys, Moti Bupol and Roy Barak. And my theory is this, that they were passing by where the crash site was, and they dumped Ziad Jarrah's belongings there. So that's speculation, and that's my theory regarding how they can put Ziad Jarrah on the plane itself when he really wasn't on the plane, that I think he wasn't on the plane.
What do you think about the other passports, the ones in Manhattan and the one at the Pentagon? Are those legit or those planted?
Well, I mean, look, I can understand, how could a passport survive? And I also hear I'm pretty sure you're familiar with this. Well, they should have made the World Trade Center out of the passports.
Yeah,
a bang on the building itself in concrete steel. Well, if you understand how kinetic energy works, well, when a plane crashes into a building or a hard surface, here's the hard surface, here's the plane, you're basically, it's like a can crushing into a surface. So everything that was behind the plane is crashing to the front of the plane in a matter of a millisecond. So everything that is hard surfaced, everything that is liquid based is going to evaporate on time. Paper will survive. It's very light. It's going to survive. Now, if you want to say that Saddam al-Sisqabi passport was planted, well, then they must have did a really bad job of linking an Iraqi to 9/11, because Saddam al-Sisqabi is a Saudi. Mm-hmm. And when they found his passport, it was basically from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. That's where he was born. If you're going to connect Iraq to 9/11, why not make Saddam al-Sisqabi an Iraqi passport? Unless you were willing to say that they didn't really think this thing through. Well, think of it like this. At Flight 93, they found IDs and driver's licenses of people who were passengers on the plane. Mm-hmm. They actually found an ID card of one of the airline attendants, CC Lyles. They found a Florida ID belonging to a cab driver who was in Flight 93. Were those planted too? I mean, yeah, paper can survive, but yeah, it's a little bit mysterious that they find these passports so it could link that, there were hijackers on these planes and it was this guy. But we do know there were hijackers on these planes because the phone calls were made on the planes and they were received by loved ones and from the authorities as well. And so who were these people on these planes? Were those the real names the FBI gave? Well, I think some of them were, because the family members did come out and say, yeah, we know that he's missing in Afghanistan and we didn't hear from him anymore and stuff. So, yeah, I think some of those passports were legit, actually.
Yeah. So what was I going to ask? Do you think that Dick Cheney, purposefully decided not to shoot down Flight 77 because he knew it was going for the Pentagon? What do you think about that whole story?
It's an interesting conundrum for the no planers, right?
Yeah.
There's no plane. What is he talking about? Right. Okay. All right. So Dick Cheney basically was in charge of the national defense, because at this point, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld is outside of the building, which is a huge alarm right there, because there were other, later on, I think it was through Vanity Fair, did an article about why this was such a big issue, because the country's under attack. Secretary of Defense is not at his office. because he wants to help people outside of the building. I don't know why that was, but it's pretty suspicious there. So who's in charge of national defense? Well, Bush is on Air Force One trying to land somewhere, and he can't. Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld is basically outside. He's not at his desk, so he's not the PEOC, which is the Presidential Executive Emergency Office Command Center. Dick Cheney's there, and he's now in charge because these two guys are temporarily indisposed to answer the call. So Cheney actually is actually on the phone, and I don't know who he was talking to, but there was a naval aide. His name was John Cochran, who basically comes into the room and says, sir, there's a plane and it is 60 miles out. No response. He basically comes back into the room and he basically says, sir, the plane is 50 miles out. And he basically says this and he comes back in the room. He says, well, sir, the plane is 10 miles out. Now he's like, you know, did the orders still stand? And Cheney is alleged to have said when he turned around, he quipped his neck and he says, well, of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything different? Now, what is he talking about? Is he talking about a shoot down order? Well, the national defense is basically all over the United States at this point, and they are not to stop their exercise programs. There was a number of exercise programs happening on September 11th. Vigilant Guardian was one, Global Guardian, Amalgam Virgo 1, Amalgam Virgo 2. Those are just some of them. And so there's no shoot down because these planes are basically, when they conduct these exercises, are not hot guns. So in other words, there's no weapons on these planes. And they would have to go back, load the planes on the weapons. They have to get authorization for this from Cheyenne Mountain to get this authorization for it. So it's not a shoot down order. This is a stand down order. I mean, this is obvious a stand down order to not shoot down the plane, but to let it go through and impact the Pentagon, because it wasn't the attack of the World Trade Center, which we went to war with. It was the attack at the Pentagon, because after the attack at the Pentagon, this came from Rumsfeld lips, where he basically said, we're at war. Mm-hmm. Well, I would think we would have been at war when Flight 11 crashed into North Tower. But at that point, people actually thought it was an accident. But right. When 175 crashed into the South Tower, I mean, everybody and their mother knew we were under attack. But that wasn't an act of war yet, because at that point, we're still wrapping our heads around it. And the Pentagon was an obvious target. It was a target for many years. In fact, they did an exercise in October of 2000 called Mascal Operation. It was called Mascal, M-A-S-C-A-L. And it was basically an operation where if a plane hit the Pentagon, what would be the response? And this is in October of 2000. And the reason why they were doing that is because there were intelligence reports that the Pentagon was one of the targets that people wanted to crash a plane into. And that is another anomaly as well. Look, they had overwhelming data, the intelligence services, that there was something big and it was going to happen either, they didn't know what day, allegedly, but they knew that they wanted to hijack planes and crash them. But there was a number of different targets. So they like, it was impossible to defend. But the Pentagon was one of them. And yeah, I think Cheney basically wanted the Pentagon to be attacked. And look where the plane crashed into. It crashed into the most empty area of the building, the renovation of the building. And this renovation has been going on not just overnight, as some truthers would say. The renovation program, I think, began in 1993, where they wanted to renovate the whole building. And that was the West Wing of the building in which they were renovating. And yeah, there was cameras on top of those roofs of the Pentagon, but they weren't working. Why? Because it was under renovation. And let's just say, I think you brought this up the other day in your thread. Let's just say that there was videotape showing that a plane hit the Pentagon. How many of you know planes would actually reverse your position? Or would you say that this was, oh, basically this came from the Department of Defense. We can't believe it. So, you know, I would try to tell you, I'm not pushing you away because I think you're victims. And you're not, and to me, you're not kooks. You're just misled. I was there too. You know, I watched Loose Change. I really believed that no plane hit the Pentagon, no plane crashed in Shankville. But then I started doing my own independent study and found out, yeah, there was. And that's not me agreeing with the official narrative of 9/11. The official narrative of 9/11 is not just about hijacking planes and crashing them, you know, into New York and Pennsylvania and Pentagon. It's much bigger than that. And the 9/11 Commission ignored so much stuff. And when you read the 9/11 Commission report, you basically see, yeah, they left out a lot of stuff and they ignored a lot of stuff. And they told the narrative that they wanted to tell. And yeah, that's my beef with no players, no hijackers, is that, you know, they should stop listening to people who are manipulating them and fooling them so that they can, you know, rake in Patreon money or, you know, stay relevant. But to do your own thinking and do your own research and don't listen to nobody, not even me. You know, don't believe me just because I'm saying it. I want you to believe, you know, take my words, you research for yourself, and you'll find out who is right and who is wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I've noticed that in the Libertarian Party, there's a lot of people who have become big fishes in small ponds. And once you enter and you start making waves and you start getting more attention than they do, they start getting really angry. I think there's a lot of that in the 9/11 kook movement because there's kind of a monopoly on that. So if you have people like you or Ryan Dawson or others who are exposing the bullshit as bullshit, it really threatens the, you know, the, what they've cultivated over the years. Scott Horton just did a really, I wouldn't even call it a debate. It was just a complete murder of Bill Kristol on live, you know, live on YouTube. Last week. And he was talking a lot about how the hijackers and Osama bin Laden and Al Qaeda garnered so much support because of what we were doing in Israel and Saudi Arabia, like keeping our bases in Saudi Arabia and supporting the Israeli ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians and, you know, all this over the years. And it led to a lot of, you know, a lot of people having sympathy for Al Qaeda. That all falls apart too if you don't think there are any hijackers. Like the whole idea of blowback, you know, a lot of Ron Paul supporters believe that 9/11 was a complete inside job. Ron Paul doesn't agree with you. This is kind of where he became famous when he had his Rudy Giuliani moment, talking about how 9/11 was blowback from our policies in Saudi Arabia and Israel. So that's also an interesting dichotomy I've noticed, that so many people who acknowledge that blowback is a real thing and talk about it all the time, they simultaneously don't believe that this was a case of blowback and that we had to manufacture a reason to go into the Middle East. And I just find that interesting. I just wanted your comments on that.
It was a crushing debate itself. It was one-sided. And I knew this going in because this debate was actually supposed to happen a year prior, but because of COVID, it basically pushed back the date. And I lived in New York and I tried to get the day off to go to the event itself and I couldn't. So I watched it at work at certain points when I got a break. And it was better than I even expected because Horton was much focused, and you could tell by his body language, he was ready, he was focused, he, you know, was pretty edgy, but he wasn't uncivil. Kristol was just flabbergasted, just defeated. Very few people were in support of him, even in his hometown, where he grew up in Midtown, New York. He was just crushed, and how could he defend himself? And I'm pretty shocked that Kristol actually, even after the COVID restriction, had time to think and do his homework about what, you know, who Horton really was and what he was going to bring to the table. He still went on with it. During certain times of the debate, actually, one part of the debate, I'm pretty sure you found this to be amusing, was when Kristol said he was anti-war. I couldn't believe it. I said, oh, my God, that's the meme of the night, right? Right. Here's a guy who basically wrote in the Weekly Standard for years about how to just recently tried to conduct regime change in China. He wrote that in 2018 before, you know, we really got on the stage of China. The Project for New American Century, I mean, which he co-authored in 1998, which was basically an outline of how U.S. imperialism could work in the Middle East, especially through an invasion of Iraq. It was a blueprint for the U.S. military and the expansion thereof, save for the regarding of a precipitating event just like Pearl Harbor, which 9/11 was. And that's, you know, truth is like to concentrate just on that issue. But it was a much more broader expansion. And it was written by some of the most ardent neoconservatives ever to live. Robert Kagan, who was co-author of the PNOC document, Douglas Feith, Paul Wolfowitz, all these names you're familiar with. And so these people are basically authorizing the use of military force throughout the Middle East. And it was all precipitated under the school of Leo Strauss, where he's considered the godfather of neoconservatism of the present day. And this was basically echoed throughout the years in Afghanistan in the early 1980s, when communism was still a presence in the Middle East. At some point, Afghanistan was the basis center. The Soviet Union was supporting most of these presidents, Hafizul Amin, for one, Barbak Kamal later on. And so the religious sector were basically getting slaughtered. And because of that, they were calling for the Muslim community to come and help. They basically did. And knowing this, the CIA basically were funding, through the use of the Pakistan ISI, weapons and money. I think they spent somewhere up to like $770 million worth of armament training. And we were training these Mujahideen, who later on would come and be a part of the most notorious terrorist groups in the world. And so because of that, there was blowback, as you said, blowback, massive blowback from this, because after the Cold War was defeated, after the Soviets retreated, we basically left Afghanistan. And in doing so, there were two civil wars, which were much bloodier than the 10-year war with the Soviet Union. And that gave rise to who? The Taliban. The Taliban came out of Pakistan, Islamabad, and Peshawar, led by Muhammad Mullah Omar, who led a religious community. And because of that, they wanted to suppress any communist influence within the country. And by doing so, they just slaughtered all these Pashtuns, native farmers, women, children, some of the most ghoulish leaders like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, Abu Hadraj al-Iraqi. Just these guys are the worst of the worst. And later on, all those people, the Mujahideen, then left Afghanistan and went back to the United States, the Philippines, Indonesia. And what did they create? Well, they would help to create Al-Qaeda. They would help to create Boko Haram in northern Afghanistan, northern Africa. They would help to create Abu Sayyaf in the Philippines and Indonesia, Jemaah Islamiyah, all these radical fundamentalist groups who all had at some point training or funding from the money, the CIA, and all these foreign intelligence services like the Pakistan ISI, the Israeli Mossad, the British MI6, all these funding and training went to these people, and they went back and they conducted their own jihad against those own countries. And guess what happened? All these terrorist attacks happened around the country, and the intelligence community are saying, what's going on here? We don't know what's happening, when they are the precipitators of this. Now, I'm not saying that these are CIA agents or CIA or Israeli Mossad agents. No, all they needed was a push. And that's what they gave them, a push. And they conducted the terrorism on their own, but in a very controlled manner. And, you know, 9/11 happened. And 9/11 was just a pretext. What came after 9/11? Much worse. The National Defense Authorization Act, the Patriot Act, the invasion of Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, drone strikes in Pakistan, Yemen, the subjugation of the Shiite minority. And that's the bigger geopolitical angle. And of course, the draconian policies of the United States, as well as the erosion of certain civil liberties that are slowly being eroded so you won't take advantage. And that's what I'm talking about in context of the broader geopolitical angle of 9/11. And that's much more important than saying, oh, there's no planes and no hijackers. Because once you say there's no planes and no hijackers, guess what? Now you have to do any homework. You have to do any homework about the intelligence apparatuses, the backgrounds of these people, or the greater geopolitical angle. All you have to say, and you can keep saying it for the rest of the time, is that, oh, I just know the official story is false.
Yeah. That's it. I mean, this is an evergreen problem that skeptics, contrarians, libertarians, anti-establishment people have, is that instead of thinking critically, they just start thinking the opposite of whatever is being told to them. And I made a thread about this today that I think is very important, that the establishment is going to try to tell as close to the truth as they can so that they have a story that sells. You know, they're not going to make everything up and tell you a complete lie. They're going to mix it with the truth. So if you are just contrarian, you are by default going to be wrong pretty much all the time, because they're always going to have some tidbit of truth in their story. And you see this with COVID. Like, you see people who still believe that COVID doesn't exist, that it's made up. Well, then how are you going to indict Fauci for his connections with the Wuhan lab, where you think COVID was made? Like, it just doesn't make any sense. Most people don't think it through. They don't get to the point of connecting the dots. But, you know, it's just really important to actually, like you said, approach it like a crime scene. Try to find out what is true. If you're just opposed to everything the establishment says and you just want to, you know, be 100% against it, you're acting as if you're living in a vacuum where everything that is told to you is a lie. That's how you end up being a flat earther. That's how you end up being a no planer. That's how you end up being someone who doesn't believe COVID exists at all. And you are just as dumb and useless as somebody who's wearing a mask with a sign screaming at you, trust the science. Mm-hmm. You know, you hate those people because they don't think and they just go with a narrative and just cling onto it religiously, regardless of what can disprove what they've said. But you have become the exact same fucking thing. Mm. I just want your comments on that.
Yeah, no, and I'm glad you brought this up, because one thing that we haven't really touched on is the media manipulation of the people themselves. And I believe I could go further back regarding former Reich Minister of Propaganda, Joseph Goebbels, who once said the famous quote that if you tell a lie enough times, people will believe it. Well, in regards to any human event in history, which you said to me earlier, whether it be World War I, World War II, JFK, 9/11, if you put out propaganda, you put out disinformation, and you are part of the intelligence community, all you need to do is just whisper it. And whisper it to a person who has influence. Example, Alex Jones. Alex Jones has a million people, millions and millions of people that follow him. And all he has to do is repeat this narrative. And then it'll be repeated by his followers. And throughout the years and decades, this narrative will take a form of like a branch approach. Well, it'll have different narratives and different fringe conspiracies. And the whole premise is that as long as you're repeating these narratives, the one thing you're not concentrating on is the narrative which goes to show back to the real proprietors of this lie, of the crime itself, or allowing the crime, which is usually the intelligence community or the federal government, which is basically one and the same, whether it be foreign intelligence, whether it be domestic intelligence. Regardless, the real power of all manipulation of most crime in the world come from the intelligence community, because information is power, and you can manipulate and you can construct certain narratives that benefit you or your agendas or your company's agendas or your agency's agendas for the greater geopolitical goal. And that's the most important point, because whether you want to believe in no planes or no hijackers or COVID's fake or nothing like that, guess what? You're held in a state of belief, which is a metastasizing, paralyzing feeling, because with belief, you cannot act on it. And there's a great quote I love to live by. I try to live by every day. He was written by E. Martin Schatz. He wrote a quote to Vincent Salandria, both are JFK researchers. And the name of the quote is Belief Versus Knowledge. And I won't read the whole quote, but basically he says that the problem with the American people is that they're allowed to believe anything, but to know nothing. Because with knowledge, you can act on it. So right. when it comes to 9/11, you can believe there were no planes. You can believe there were no hijackers. You can believe Judy Wood had space beings with melted towers. Hell, you could believe World Trade Center 7 came down by natural causes or controlled demolition. Guess what? Do you know it? That's the difference. Because you can believe and you can say whatever you want. The only thing that matters is we can go to court with it. That's what matters. Because when it comes to court, we need evidence, knowledge. And that's the reason why I will continue to try and upload many videos and articles and interviews as much as I can. And thankfully, with your help today in promoting me and stuff like that, which I shamelessly thank you and thank you enough. But I'm trying to awaken people. I don't want people to follow me. And I know there's people that follow me, but what I want from them is more important. I want them to take the information I'm saying, look it up to see if it's true, and you build your channel. You build and you write articles, you do videos, because where there's more informed people, we can start to build a movement. Instead of movement of followers, we now have movement of leaders that can do something and we can act on it.
Yeah. Well, the only thing I disagree with there is I do want people to follow you so that they, they can find out more about this and be more informed. I was lucky. I came into this. I've been a libertarian for a while, but I joined the Libertarian Party and came into this media space at a very advantageous time. I filled a void that wasn't really there. And then I met certain people at the right time. And just the combination of all of it, caused me to blow up. I've got like almost 20,000 followers on Twitter, almost 7,000 subscribers here. But what I try to do with that luck is I try to point people in the right direction, point them toward people who really have done a lot of research and are really good people to listen to. People like you, Ryan Dawson, Scott Horton, Peter Schiff, you know, the people who actually know this stuff inside and out. I do have one super chat here that wanted to ask a question, and then we'll do your plugs and get out of here. Maxim Parkinkov says, could Adam touch on the multiple failed abandoned attacks that didn't go through? I don't know if he's talking about 1993 or I don't.
Oh, no, he's I know exactly. This is a good question. I know exactly what he's referring to. There was additional hijackings that was supposed to take place on 9/11. One in particular, and I did a podcast episode about it regarding United Airlines Flight 23. Not many people know about this because it wasn't really purported by the media as well. United Flight 23 was supposed to be a plane that was going to take off out of JFK and land at LAX, which 11 and 175 were going to. And on that plane, while it was on the runway, the CEO of United Airlines, Gerald Arpry, told the pilots, and he sent an ACARS message, which is a message meant for the pilots of United Airlines, where he says, barricade your doors and don't take off. And when that happened, they were on the runway. They were about to fly. So they go back to the gate. They barricade the doors. And the flight attendant gets the message from the pilot saying, tell the passengers, we're not taking off. We're going back to the gate. When she did this, three men got up, Arab men. They got up and started yelling at the flight attendant saying that we need to fly. And so they were trying to open the door to the cockpit. And so she gets nervous and she calls security on the phone at JFK. So they go to the gate, they deplane, everyone gets off, and these guys just mix with the crowd and they disappear. Well, when security gets to the airport, to the airplane, they find the overhand luggage of these guys because everyone else took their luggage. And what did they find their luggage? They find box cutters, a flight training manual out of Florida, and I think they found a pilot's uniform. Now, was this a separate coincidence? I don't think so. Now, according to, now take this with a grain of salt. According to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, this is coming when he was tortured, all right? So grain of salt. The original operation for 9/11 was to involve 10 planes. 10 hijacked planes, crashed them into high valley targets around the city, and have Khalid Sheikh Mohammed on the 10th plane where he would kill all the men, leave the women alive and the children, and land that plane and then give a media interview about why 9/11 was allowed to happen. Bin Laden actually rejects this idea because he says it would take too many people. So they agreed on 4 planes. However, I'm not saying these guys were Al-Qaeda, but if they weren't, wouldn't that fit with the anomalies that I'm trying to tell you here today? This would go against the official narrative purported by the FBI and 9/11 Commission, because who were these guys? Well, 3 years ago, I filed a Freedom of Information request regarding the flight manifest of this plane, and I was told to get a warrant because I'm not a cop, which was the right answer. But DJ Thermal Detonator actually did a film basically on this, and in that film, it shows that I think it was one or three of the people involved with that attempted hijacking on September 13th, when they opened up the airports again, over like 100, I think it was like 60 people, Arabs, all arrested because they were trying to either plant weapons on a plane or to court weapons on a plane. One was actually dressed as a pilot and he was trying to get on the plane. And this person was a relative of Bin Laden. And one of them was, one of the people who were trying to hijack Flight 23. That's just one of them. And also, CNN did a report on September 13th about finding box cutters taped on the backs of the food trays on the plane of the seats. And there was a number of weapons. A gun was found. Also, there was something I didn't bring up before. In Flight 170, Flight 11, it was reported by the American Airlines. They were going to draft a report that Daniel Lewin, who is an Israeli anti-terrorism, the group's name is Sayarat Mascaral. I'm butchering the name, but he was an Israeli counterterrorism agent. He was the first person killed on 9/11, and the person who killed him was Satam al-Saskami, the guy whose passport was found. He was seated behind him, but it was alleged that he was stabbed. But according to the American Airlines report that was going to be written that night, he was shot. Now, where did they get the gun from? Well, if you want to look into a bigger conspiracy, there was a number of people that were trying to plant weapons on the planes the night before. And I'll go real quick. There was these six men at Logan Airport that were trying to get in. Three of them were dressed as ramp workers. And so there was a security guard named Eric Gill who worked for Augenbrite Security. He saw them trying to get into the tarmac where the plane was. And so he stopped them and said, "What are you doing?" And he got into an argument with them. They left. And so his shift ended at 10 p.m. The next day, 9/11 happened. He went back to work. And then a week later, Time Magazine published the photographs of the hijackers. And he saw two people who he argued with the night before, Marwan al-Shehhi and Nawaf al-Hazmi. And if you want to make the argument that how did a gun or a long knife enter these planes, well, it is reported that there were people planting weapons on planes well before they even took off. There was an investigation into this with Augenbrite Security, and the only man ever held accountable for 9/11 was a guy who wasn't even part of the terrorist plot or anything, Frank Augenbrite. He got fired from Augenbrite Security because too many people were allowed to work at these airports without any background checks at all. And most of these people were Arab. Huh. And so that's another anomaly you could look into. There's many others, but it would take another hour to bring up a lot of these anomalies. But look what you're throwing away in replace for no hijackers, no hijacked planes.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'll certainly have to get you back on, talk about more of this stuff. We ought to have you on the Four Horsemen sometime. That would be fun.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
And for everyone saying that I'm living in an echo chamber, like I actually have been talking with Jason Burmis. I am going to get him on the show sometime and talk to him, because I don't think anyone should be shut out. But I do think that, you know, you reach a point where you have to stop entertaining some things. Like, things shouldn't be too controversial to talk about, but eventually some things are just so dumb that you shouldn't really entertain. I mean, like, flat earth is a great example. Anyone who believes the earth is flat, like, you just have to question everything else they say at a certain point. Like, so if you are someone at least who still doesn't believe that they flew planes into the World Trade Center, which I know Jason Burmis does believe that, but if you're someone who doesn't believe that, like, I'm sorry, but I mean, I just really don't care about anything else you have to say. But I really appreciate you coming on, Adam. This was a great conversation. Where can people follow you? Where can they keep up with you? I've got your Twitter and your YouTube linked in the description. You got anything special coming up? What can people do?
Yeah, well, special coming up. I just interviewed Julie Sears, worked under the Defense Intelligence Agency, who was the last person to see Ahmed Massoud alive before he was killed by Al-Qaeda and bin Laden. I think in a week I might be interviewing Peter Dale Scott, and probably at the end of the month, Peter Lance, who wrote 1,000 Years for Revenge, a book there. Well, just Google my name, Adam Fitzgerald. I don't hide under any other name. Adam Fitzgerald 9/11. You could Google that, and I come right up. I'm on Podbean. The name of the podcast is The Darkened Hour. I'm on YouTube, Adam Fitzgerald. Twitter _ Adam Fitzgerald. YouTube, Adam Fitzgerald. I mean, yeah, I'm on Medium too. Just Google my name. I come right up, and I'm open to the public. If there's any questions, like, anywhere on any environment, I try to be as accessible, because when I first started, there wasn't many people I could turn to, and or they were hard to get to because they were so overwhelmed with people. And now, with a little bit more people now talking about this subject, more serious people, I have the time to try and reach people. But yeah, I agree with the echo chamber response. You know, Jason, I have no beef with Jason Burmis. I just have a disagreement with him regarding Shankville and the Pentagon. And I would be open to talk with him as well. I mean, there's no problem with that either.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for watching. I'm actually going to be going live again in a couple hours with, actually don't know what his first name is, but he goes under American Trucker on Twitter. So we're going to have a lot in common to talk about. But yeah, thanks again, Adam, for coming on, and I'll catch all you guys on the next stream.